From Relay FM, this is Upgrade episode number 30. Today's show is brought to you by 1Password from Agile Bits. Put passwords in their place. By Citrix GoToMeeting, make it easy to meet with your team wherever you need to, wherever you are. And by MailRoute, a secure hosted email service for protection from viruses and spam. My name is Jason Snell. I normally don't read this part of the show because Mike Hurley does, but Mike is on vacation. And so he couldn't take it. Two episodes in a row where he and I spoke to each other in person, face to face across a table, and he just couldn't take it. He cracked up and had to be sent away for some rest and relaxation to get his head together. So instead, I have a guest star visiting me, and I believe this is the first time that he and I have shared a tech podcast together, although we've been on many episodes of The Incomparable and other things together. It's your favorite from ATP. It's John Siracusa. Hi, John.
I'm pretty sure we did a 5x5 special about an Apple event or something,
and we were
both there.
That could be. That's possible. I just think it's funny.
We should just talk about Miyazaki just in case, though.
Oh, yeah, we could do that. That just makes, there's some people who are very angry when Michael and I talked about movies that he hasn't seen that I made him watch. And they're like, I didn't sign up for this. And it's like, well, we put it at the end. You could, like, tune, just stop it.
Did you put it after the song? Oh, wait.
Yeah. We do have a song. We have a little song. We could have done that. We don't have a post show kind of thing like you guys do. I should ask Marco this and not you, but is there a philosophy behind the ATP when the theme song goes? Because on The Incomparable, I always consider, like, anything I put after the music is, like, literally not essential. Like this is all optional material after this point.
Yeah, we got an interesting email. I guess we'll probably talk about it in the next ATP, but someone emailed and said they thought their podcast client wasn't working. Like, it works with every show, but with ATP, for some reason, it's like it's jumping around, or he thought he had finished an episode, but it sounded like it was starting again. So, A, maybe this person has some weird problem with the Apple Podcast app, or B, they're confused by the fact that when they think they've finished an episode and they've heard the song, that they go back to the episode and there's still more to play. Yeah. So there is a philosophy. It's basically, it's a tech podcast. We talk about tech stuff. We do all the sponsors and all the tech stuff that we want to cover before the song. Then the song comes, and afterward is kind of talking about the show that we just did, but also any sort of non-tech stuff. So if we just want to talk about cars, it's going to be in that part. If we want to talk about our feelings being heard on Twitter, it's going to be in that part. Sometimes it's carryover tech stuff because we're talking about the tech stuff we just did in the main part of the program. And so it's like, well, you just continue talking about tech. Why was that even there? Or if we didn't get to a tech topic, it'll be back there. But it's all kind of like more casual, retrospective, and it's like a grab bag. So there is a philosophy, but it's super loose.
Yeah, I get it. And I get why people would be confused. But, you know, what you don't want to do is create something that Dan Benjamin started and that I do and that we occasionally do on Relay as well, which is the After Dark bonus track B-side kind of thing. Because that's like, then you're really saying it's like, this is for super fans only. And what I like about ATP and how you guys handle it is it's like, look, there's the show and then there's some other stuff we're also going to talk about that you get to listen to, but it's not in the show. It's not the sponsors. It can be off topic. That's why I find it funny when people complain to you guys about what you do in the post show, because it's like, literally, this is bonus, people. We could have just ended the show when the music stopped.
I think some people don't know that part of the show exists because they just hit stop after the song. And I always wonder about those people. But there is extra stuff. For the live listeners, we have all sorts of BS that would probably go in, you know, the bonus track type of thing in Incomparable parlance. But that we just don't even release. Yeah. So that does still exist, but it's only for the live listeners, and there's very few of them.
Right. That's true. I mean, relatively speaking, very few. And they have their own bootlegs and things like that, too, which is pretty serious. Pretty serious stuff. On this show, we usually do some follow-up. I have one item of follow-up. Would you like to hear it?
Go for it.
Well, this is hashtag Mike was wrong, because in previous episodes, Mike has been talking about being right, and he's like a pusher, but what he's pushing is iPhone 6 Pluses, and I just wanted to mention that I wrote a piece on 6 colors. It'll be in the show notes, which I should say you can find at relay.fm/upgrade/30 or in the podcast client you're listening to right now, called 2 Weeks with the iPhone 6 Plus, where I wrote about the fact that I've been using it for the last 2 weeks. When I was in Europe, I used it because I had an unlocked 6 Plus that I had access to. And in the end, I decided that the only thing I really liked about it was the fact that the battery was battery life was better. And otherwise, when I came back and I switched, and literally, John, I'm standing in the line at customs at the airport, and I've got my iPhone 6 turned on, and I'm using it, and I found myself like grasping it with two hands, like almost like I'm huddling near a fire to stay warm or something like that. And I realized over 2 weeks I'd built up this gesture that was me kind of clutching the phone in order to not drop it because it was so huge that I needed like the extra hand in the other corner. So what I'm saying is I learned something about myself, which is I do a lot of one-handed phone checking and stuff with my thumb, and it totally doesn't work on the 6 Plus because I can't even reach the bottom right corner with my thumb on the 6 Plus. And then even Mike said that he does a lot of kind of like gymnastics to get the phone in the right position to press certain things in certain places on the phone. It's like, it's too much. It's too much. So I appreciated my time with the 6 Plus. It was great having an unlocked phone in Europe because there is some great, you can buy, I bought for £20. I bought a SIM card that was unlimited data for 30 days. And I was only there for 14 in the UK and Ireland where I went. And that was all great. But I have to say that For myself, I think I made the right decision in getting the 6 Plus and getting the 6 and not the 6 Plus.
I read your thing already because I had a sneak preview of as soon as it was posted, it appeared in Twitter and my Slack feed. Yes, so I already read it, and I've heard Marco on ATP talked about his experiences with the 6 Plus also in Ireland. And I've never had the opportunity to try one. I've held one in the store, but I've never lived with one for any period of time. I would imagine that what would happen is, like, even with my 6, which is bigger than my series of iPod touches that preceded it, right, I tend to use it like a little iPad sometimes, mostly because my actual iPad is an iPad 3 and it's really slow. So if I'm doing anything like playing a game where the frame rate isn't quite so good on my iPad 3 or doing a web page that's JavaScript heavy or something, sometimes I use it like a little iPad. You know, I'm laying down on my bed and I'll put it on my chest like a little iPad and hold it with two hands. It is a very small iPad. I would imagine a 6 Plus would be a little bit closer to being like an iPad and maybe make me use my iPad even less. But if I had an iPad Air 2, I don't know if it would contend. And like you said, I don't, you know, the biggest issue for me is how big the darn thing is, just portability wise. Wrapping my hands around it, sticking it in my pockets, as Marco was finding, the difficulty of just sitting uncomfortable. If it doesn't fit in your pockets in the normal way and you have to change how you sit, or like he said, I think putting it on the table.
Yeah, I found myself putting it on the table too, which is weird because I don't do that. And I found myself putting it on the table because it's like, well, I could put the, you know, this back in my pocket, but I'll just leave it out.
You have to stand up to get it into your pocket, and putting it on your table is dangerous because it's more susceptible to spills. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Mike had dropped his a bunch of times, although I don't know if he also dropped his 5 and 5S.
I thought that was a weird thing where he actually admitted, I mean, to Mike's credit, he admitted all the flaws and things that he had learned to live with the 6 Plus, and dropping it is definitely one of them. I said to him that I was using the Maps app to get to my friend's house in London where I was staying. I got off the tube. I've got the data plan because I bought the card in a vending machine at the baggage claim, and it was £5. I knew what the cost, the regular cost was. It was £5 more, and I was like, well, this way I'll have data, and I can be sure of the right way to go to get to my friend's house. So I'm out there, and I'm looking at the Maps app, and I realize that I can't reach my thumb across it, and I'm trying to like move it into a different position, I'm holding my suitcase with one hand, so I'm trying to do this one-handed, and I realized I just couldn't do it. I had to stop and put the suitcase down and do all of that. And I told this story to Mike, and he said, oh, yeah, you know, you'll get more confident in holding it in those weird positions where it feels like it's about to drop, but it also sometimes you drop it.
That's not like a good thing at all. You'll get more confident, and then you'll drop it more.
I didn't think it was a very strange statement for him to make. Like, you drop it, but you got it in a case and it's fine.
My 6 has taken a tumble many times, but not out of my hand. It's always like I'll put it on my nightstand and then somehow it will get knocked off my nightstand by myself or a pillow or a child, or it's always being knocked off of things into cracks between furniture. I guess I'm always sort of balancing it precariously on the edges of the side of sofas and ends of tables. None of them have done any damage other than to put a tiny little nick in my leather case in the corner, and it's really annoying me. But I'm resisting buying a new whatever the heck it is $80 leather case just because it has a nick in the corner.
I should say there's also a funny thing that Doug Beal in the chat room just mentioned, which is Georgia Dow from iMore pointed out that she has a case that she stuck this little like elastic hand strap on the back. And everybody who's an iPhone 6 Plus user was like checking it out. Well, you know, you can like pass your fingers through it and hold it like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was thinking having it like any kind of handle or a knob or a strap or a loop or a, you know, a thing to put one or two fingers through. Yeah. Those are all good things.
Yeah. And you know, I thought it was funny that everybody was cheering that hand strap thing because it was a combination of being a very clever hack to hold the phone better and to be complete failure because you have to stick a thing on the back of your case.
If you got an even bigger strap, perhaps it could fit all the way around your wrist. Mm. And then you'd have like a little screen on your wrist. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
That's
here.
A crazy idea. Well, at that point, I think you just get an iPad and you get that and you go full on with that Velcro ball thing that Mike and I were talking about.
Did you read that? I think it was in the Wired article about the, you know, one of the things where Apple was opening up to the press and they mentioned how one of the early Apple Watch prototype things was literally taking an iPhone and putting a Velcro strap on it and strapping it to your wrist.
Yeah, with a like an emulator of the watch on it.
A little picture of a watch on your iPhone.
Yeah, pretend that. I wonder if they like skin tone around it. Like
it's going to be the Apple Watch 6 Plus. Just watch. Mike will be telling everybody they've got to get that. They're like gauntlets, really. You just put them on this huge glass things on the top of your forearm.
Then you don't drop it because it's tied to your body.
And you can defend against attacks with swords by just putting up your forearm.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Right. That's true. It's like you're becoming Iron Man at that point, really.
Yep.
I should mention Stephen Hackett also wrote a thing, and Marco Arment is in the process, I believe, of writing something too about the 6 Plus thing. So I think it's great that not everybody has the chance to test drive a different phone model for a couple of weeks, and so I think that's one of the reasons we write this stuff is to say, well, look, here's what we noticed when we did this. I think since not everybody can do that if it informs people a little bit about what their choices are, and they're definitely going to be able to hear both sides of the argument because it didn't work for me, but I know it works for Mike and Stephen Hackett. And I'm yet to hear exactly. I think Marco is sort of, he sees a little bit more of the pros and cons of both of them. So I'm looking forward to his.
Did you hear that ATP episode where he talked about the UL trip and everything?
I have heard I've heard like half of it.
Yeah, because he talks about the 6 Plus extensively in there. This is going to be, sometimes there's a blog post that he comes on ATP and talk about, and sometimes you talk about it in something ATP and it becomes a blog post. And this
I like that. I like it when you've talked about that before. It's like the podcast that's sort of your thought process. It's like before there's a draft, there's you talking about it on the podcast. And
yep.
I do that a lot. Yeah, I actually listened to the first like half hour of ATP and then I skipped to the Twitter stuff in the post show because I knew we were going to be talking and I had that as one of my things I might want to talk about. So I have to skip back and again, maybe I'm that guy who wrote to you. So I don't understand ATP. It skips all over.
He thought it was something wrong with his podcast app. Like I don't know. He may be right. Maybe he does have a problem with his podcast app.
I bet he doesn't.
Want to do tech support over email.
I think you guys have just confused him. I hope he should use Overcast. That's what Marcus should say. Yeah, I can solve that for you.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the follow-up. We'll leave the rest for when Mike comes back. Let me take a break for our first sponsor. You know how this works, right? You know, you do this every week with Marco.
I'm there when it happens, and that's what you mean.
And he has to read the sponsor. Well, I'm going to do that now. So
good luck.
Thank you. Here I go. This episode of Upgrade brought to you by 1Password from AgileBits. 1Password, I use it. I love it. It's an essential piece of software that lets you store your passwords. The way it works is instead of having, I used to have the same password on every single site. The problem is if a site gets hacked and they figure out the passwords that were on that site, they now have your password on every site in the world. So now I use 1Password. It's on my Mac. It's on my iOS device. If you use Windows or Android, you can find it there too. They've actually even got a super cool thing where there's an HTML file hiding within their password file that you can open in a web browser and put in your password and look up your passwords that way. It automatically generates passwords for me, so I have a different strong password on every single site. They're all stored in the 1Password database, and all I have to do is remember a single password, 1Password if you will, and everything unlocks and I can get online super easy with just that 1Password that only I and perhaps my loved ones know. It saves a lot of time. The browser plugin lets you get access to the login screen right inside your browser. You don't have to go launch another app and look it up painfully. They just enabled TOTP, which is in iOS and Windows with Mac and Android coming soon. This is time-based one-time passwords, another layer of two-step security. They're always making changes. There are new, I'm on the beta stream for 1Password. There are new builds all the time. They are working endlessly to improve 1Password, which I think is also really cool. So I definitely recommend it. If you're not yet a 1Password user, you should think about changing that. So go to agilebits.com, agilebits.com/1Password, onepasword, to find out more. And you can also find 1Password, of course, on your app store of choice. So thank you so much to AgileBits and 1Password for keeping all of my passwords and logins secure and for supporting Upgrade. Put passwords in their place with 1Password. Mike's going to have some comments about that, I'm sure. Like, Jason, the ad read you did there, I would have done it much better than that. And he's probably right. But I do love 1Password, so that made that a lot easier to read. So have you been reading the Steve Jobs, the new Steve Jobs book, The Becoming Steve Jobs?
I just started it. I'm about 10% through.
10%. Well, you know, so that's a couple chapters, maybe?
Yeah. I don't know. All I know is Kindle percentages now. I have recollection of pages.
I know. Well, you can see the chapters as you go through the chapters. I just finished it. I finished it on the flight back from Ireland. I think it's pretty good, actually. And I say that as a preface because I have lots of criticisms of it, and I'm looking forward to your book report when you're done with it. I don't know if you formed any initial thoughts about it going in, or if you are expecting much, or have you accepted the hype that this is going to be the cure to the Isaacson book?
Well, I'm only 10% through, but yeah. I do have an opinion immediately of. Like the book, and now it has to, like, if it changes as the book goes on, I will change my opinion, but already I feel like I have this book's number. and it's not, I like it better than the Isaacson book so far, but there's, you know, having just read 10% of it, what I'm reading now is the early parts about Apple, his childhood, starting the company with Woz, doing the Mac project, getting Scully. Like, you know how many times I've read that story?
I know.
I've read about a million magazine articles on it. I've read tons of books about it. I've just, from every conceivable angle, I've watched documentaries about it. Just like, I've seen that story a lot, right? So the odds of there being something new in there are slim. The Isaacson book, one of the few things it had going for it is that it had a lot of, you know, it was the authorized one, and it had a lot of inside access to people who previously didn't have access to, but not much is new in there. So all I've got to go on so far in the book is sort of like tone and purpose, and the tone and purpose bother me a little bit because the book is kind of being presented as a reaction to other books or popular narratives, mm-hmm. which I guess is one way you can go with it. It's not really what I'm looking for out of what I was looking for out of the Isaacson son is like Isaacson book is a sort of a definitive biography where you just get all the facts and lay them out documentary style. If you do have an agenda, I want you to hide it better, like yeah. really well, you know, again, one of my favorite biography ever is The Power Broker, which definitely has an agenda, but it's just so massively supported by just fact after fact, interview after interview. Like, it is, you know, it's not just asserted. And in this book, a lot of it is like, here's what happened, which, of course, I know all this stuff already. And then a line from the authors saying, people always say this, but really, Jobs is like that. Just asserted. And then more events took place. And it's like, well, wait a second, those events don't support that at all. Like, they could, you know, that is a plausible interpretation of events, but you can't just say, people always say that Steve Jobs is really mean. But actually, he's kind of like, it doesn't fit. And so it reads like, that's why people are on it as like a defense of Apple, that it is, you know, some people say mean things about Steve Jobs, but actually he wasn't that bad. And then more events. And it's like, it's not apologetic so much as like a book with an agenda not particularly well supported by the facts. Because the facts are the same as the facts in everything else.
Right. Right?
Especially in this early part of the story. It's a different interpretation, not really delved into, just used as like a premise. They'll just lay that out in a one sentence thing, or at the end, the one sentence thing that says, even though these are the same events that everyone else has recorded, they're really not that bad, and it shows that he's not really that bad a guy. Well, wait a second, you just came to a different conclusion with the same facts, but then you didn't explain how you came to your conclusion. So
I think one of the problems here, and again, you've only read the beginning of it so far, is that this is a book that's got its strong areas, and then it's got the obligatory parts. So, like, you can't tell the Steve Jobs story, right? Except, well, you can, but it's harder to make that case if you don't tell that early part. But these guys didn't know Steve Jobs then. So they step through it. And I think what they do is they throw in some things that they feel like they're going to prove later.
Yeah, we'll see. But, like, so far, like, they go through the facts, and then they boldly assert that that what they have just retold demonstrates something about Steve Jobs that it does not demonstrate at all. Like, and they frame it in a way of, like, when other people have told the same story, they have concluded this, but really Steve Jobs is like X. Yeah. What? Why? How? You just told the exact same story as everyone else. What is leading you to believe that he's really like that? And if they explain it later in the book, then obviously, you know, well, my opinion might change. But they're not. They don't allude to future events. They just sort of say, you know, they'll go back and tell an old story, and they'll say, well, you know, what about the time when he was crying in the parking lot? That shows something. No, that perfectly fits with all the narrative. Like, it's like they are reframing the exact same things in a more sympathetic light merely by saying that we, the authors, are more sympathetic to this scenario. Like, we are not going to, in the same way that something that's going to be sensational would demonize him for the same events, they'll say, and this shows that he's an egomaniac and a jerk and every misery in his life he deserves, right? That's going in one extreme. This is going the other extreme and saying, despite all these terrible things that he's done, he was a human person with feelings too, and we shouldn't be so mean to him. And he really wasn't as bad as everyone says because he really loved his kids or whatever. Let's, like, I don't know. I'm not impressed so far, but so far it hasn't set its foot wrong in the ways that the Isaacson book has, particularly because this book didn't have the kind of access the Isaacson book has. So automatically I'm inclined to say, well, you're writing another Steve Jobs book so far. That's fine. Like, The Second Coming of Steve Jobs is another Steve Jobs book. Like, that's fine. I don't fault them for saying you had this one chance to write the definitive biography of Steve Jobs and you blew it, because they didn't and they don't. So if it just ends up being another Steve Jobs book, that's fine too.
Now, their assets are Brent Schlender's relationship with Jobs, which begins later, right? So he can't bring those assets to bear here. And then their other assets are that they got people from Apple to talk who haven't really talked about personal stuff about Steve, and that's all at the very end. So they're really limited in what they want to do. They want to tell this whole story, but they've got these very narrow kind of angles into it based on one reporter's kind of weird relationship with Steve Jobs and through their Apple access at the end. And so there are lots of kind of weird holes. And I think as it goes, it tells, you know, they do have this take. And when there's a little bit more to back it up, I feel like they're at least making an argument that, I mean, the thesis of the book is very clearly, like, a lot of the people who think that Steve Jobs was a monster are thinking about back when he was in his early days, when he was truly monstrous, but that later he was not quite so monstrous, and you should, you know, and he mellowed out a lot and was not the same guy and learned a lot. And so there's a story arc to his professional life as well as his personal life, that he learned and he grew and he changed, and he did some terrible things when he was in his 20s, but he wasn't that same guy the last 10 years of his life. And there's some evidence there.
They seem to even assert that when he was young, at his very youngest, like the crying in the parking lot story, they're saying, even the people who say he was a monster when he's young, see, he actually went out to the parking lot and cried. That it totally fits with the narrative of people calling him a monster. It is not an aberration. It is not a counterexample. That's part of the whole thing.
Keep reading it, because I think that they are a little more even-handed with that in presenting that he was totally messed up. And actually, they have a really interesting thesis, which is that he never had a mentor. He was basically he was a spoiled child. He was always allowed to do anything. And then the people he surrounded himself first, what was it, Mike Scott and then John Scully? They're like, his argument is these guys were terrible mentors. They were not capable of mentoring Steve in any way. And then it extends to sort of saying that the person who really gave that connection to him was Ed Catmull and also John Lasseter to a certain extent. And they were people where there was actually a better relationship and fit, and they helped him improve and become a better manager. I think they do an okay job of making that case. I don't know whether I entirely buy it, but I think it's an interesting take on Jobs. But again, they can't tell that part until they get to that part of the story. And so for me, I mean, I think that's why there's that first little prologue where it's like, hey, this is when I knew Steve Jobs, because then they can't do that for a long time. So they have a little flash forward.
Yeah, there's a little bit of the gonzo journalism thing where the story is a little bit about the author.
Yeah. It's in first person. There are two authors, but one of them is in first person.
The weird collective singular first person dual author. But it's like, let me tell you about my meeting with Jobs and what it was like in our relationship. And it's like, well, I don't really care about one half of that relationship, right? I don't really care. Except maybe to the extent that it's illuminating about his character. But I don't know. Like, so far, not a lot of insights in the book. And even the part that you're talking about, like with the mentor, like, oh, he needed to have a mentor and he didn't have one or whatever. As an explanation, like, of what happened, that's fine. But because the book is framed as a comeback against the popular narrative, that explanation reads more like an excuse. Like, see, he wasn't a bad guy. He just didn't have a good mentor. Like, that's... And it's because the book is framed as a sort of defense or a balancing off of everything else that it comes off more apologetic. Like, because that's not, you know, like, boo-hoo, he didn't have a good mentor. Like, that doesn't... His behavior is what his behavior is, and there's nothing... You know, you can explain the circumstances surrounding it, but you can't use that to fight back against what you consider unflattering narratives, like, because everyone agrees on the facts. It's just the interpretations, and it's not as if, you know, you didn't have this extra piece of information. Let me tell you this piece, and that will change things. And every new piece of information that gets added just fits into the exact same puzzle piece the same picture that has been drawn by every book.
It's just piling on some more information.
It's remarkably consistent, and it's all just how you interpret it. How do you balance the good against the bad?
Right.
Because he was a complicated person. He wasn't all good, and he wasn't all bad. He did good things. He did terrible things. How do you balance it out? And, yeah, I don't know. I'll finish the book. We'll talk about it in ATP, but, you know, I am the type of person who feels like he can give a book report on a book after reading the first chapter, which is obviously what you should not do.
Well, so I also think it's worth mentioning, I do wonder sometimes if Apple endorsing this book does this book any favors, because...
Oh, no, that's the worst.
Right?
Yeah, because
it's setting it up as being an apologetic, hagiography of, isn't this... Which I don't think it is, but again, they got the Apple access and they got people... In fact, even in the book, I think Eddie Q condemns the Isaacson book in this book, which is kind of funny.
And they should. That's fine. Like, I condemn that book too, but it's kind of like what I said about a regulatory agency in ADP a while back. If you are a regulatory agency and the companies you regulate are applauding something you do, chances are you're not doing your job well. So I'm not saying that a biography is supposed to be a regulatory agency, but if you're writing a biography about the famous leader of the world's biggest technology company, the world's biggest company, period, and that company heartily endorses your book, you should be thinking to yourself, wait a second, what did I miss? Like, because there's, you know, there should be something in there that, like, they shouldn't be wholeheartedly endorsing your book. They should be endorsing maybe some parts of it, because other books have been worse. Like, they can condemn the Isaacson book, but once they're sort of, like, in the press endorsing your biography, it really undercuts, like, your credibility, whether it's fair or not. Like, it could be a perfectly balanced book. It just seems like, I was the author of the book, I'd be like, maybe just, you know, not so much on how much you love the book, because it makes me seem like a shill.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that's bothering me, and I've got a little list here, which I'll go through really quickly, is, and you know, this is anything that you see that's reported that's something you know a lot about, you see the mistakes and you think, oh, that's really oversimplified, or they got that wrong a little bit. I don't think these mistakes necessarily make the book, the book's overarching value less or more, and the point they're trying to make stronger or weaker. Other than to say that it gives me pause that there are so many little problems I have with it that I feel like Were they afraid somebody was going to leak it if they hired a fact checker or something? Because there are a lot. Not only, the capitalized mackerel with a capital W, which really bugs me. And they say that St. Quentin Prison is in San Rafael, and it's really not. And they say that there was a black iBook, and it was a black MacBook. You know, Mac nerd stuff. But they say that at one point they assert that the clone strategy failed because clones were cheap and tarnished Apple's mystique as a maker of premium hardware, which I think is an interesting argument because my recollection of the clone era is that Apple's hardware wasn't very good. And so when you let other people make clones, people had no reason to buy Apple hardware. There were cheap clones. There were nice clones, too.
That sentence was probably off by itself in the book, though. You know, is this quote right from the book? The strategy failed to the availability of cheap clones tarnished Apple's mystique as a maker of premium hardware, period. I bet the next sentence moves on to the next topic. Like, they just flat out say...
Oh, yeah. No, it's a statement of fact that
strategy failed, and the availability of cheap clones tarnished Apple's mystique.
Yep.
Moving on. Is that it? Like, that's the story of the clones? If you had to summarize the story of the clones, that's not how I would summarize sentence, right?
But I think it feeds the narrative they want to tell in a very simple way, but I think it's not true. And that it's also a snowball as these mistakes and things that I dispute. Some of them are factual errors and some of them are assertions that I think are wrong. But, you know, the more of them I see, the more like momentum I get of like, OK, that's not right. And that's not right. And that happened to me when I read this. They talk about how the BOS is designed to also be able to use the existing Macintosh OS and thus operate like a Mac clone. BOS is a separate operating system. Yeah. It could run on Mac hardware. It did not use the Mac OS.
Right. So that's where you have to sort of decode from like non-tech person speaking. Like, I think what they're getting at is that both ran on PowerPC. I'm pretty sure that's what they're getting at, but it is so mangled that it's just becomes totally false.
It comes out backward.
Yeah, and you can kind of decipher it. Like the great one in the Isaacson book is the idea that they bought Next and then never used the Next operating system. Like as such a pivotal, not just like a techie detail. Like, oh, who cares about the tech? That's
these
just
guys,
such a pivotal,
these
a pivotal
guys get this
part
right.
of the yeah,
these
the, guys, a pivotal part of the entire acquisition of Next. It's like if you got that wrong, that's not a little thing. That is the most important acquisition Apple has ever done to define the entire future of all their products, including the phone, including the watch, including the iPad. And you're like, they never use that.
These guys did get that part right. They, because it fits their thesis to say this was the key acquisition, not just for Steve Jobs, but because that technology was the bedrock of all of the future Apple products. Right. Like, yes, that's right.
It's not asking for them to be tech geniuses to figure that out. Like that, if you know anything, like it's the basics, right? And so the BOS thing, you can kind of tell that someone somewhere, like the right idea was in there and it just came out wrong in the thing. And assertions about the clones, they don't understand. They weren't there. They weren't in the thing. Whatever, like...
Yeah. They said John Rubinstein's company, Powerhouse Systems, did Mac clones, which I think I think they're thinking Power Computing. I don't think Powerhouse Systems ever made a Mac clone. I think they were PCs that ran Next Step, but that's in there. They talk about fitting your narrative. They suggest that Steve Jobs was waiting in the wings for that appearance at Macworld Expo, and that Gil Amelio gave a long droning speech. And everybody was just impatiently waiting to get to Jobs, and Jobs had to wait, which is, I don't know if that's true or not. The story I always heard is that Jobs made them wait as a power move. He got there late.
Yep.
And Emilio had to stretch and look bad and really be boring because he couldn't speak extemporaneously to save his life. But they don't tell it that way. They tell it this opposite way, that it's like, you know, come on, get out of the way, old man. Steve Jobs coming through. And that's not my understanding. My understanding was Steve Jobs was kind of being a jerk and didn't show up.
This is a great example. Like, so I've read that version of events as well. And then here's this other version. I don't know which one of those is true. Find the people who were there and ask them, for crying out loud. Like, you know what I mean? Just.
Because those are completely opposite stories of
right.
the same
and
events.
Like, if only there was some way we could determine which one of those stories is more likely to be true, rather than reading, because I've read many variations on what happened in that particular keynote. And usually there is one source who says, he totally made Emilio wait. And the other one's like, Emilio just went on to... And this, surely there was more than two people there. Surely you can get one more than one. And there's zero sources here. This is just like... Again, I never want to get the impression when I'm reading one of these books that the person writing the book simply read one of the other seven books I've read on this topic and like summarized it like a book report. Like, there's no sourcing, there's no footnotes, there's no person they talk to. They just say this is what happened. Yep. And it's like, I read that in a magazine article once too.
Well, I've got one better for you. This is another statement of fact, which is they essentially say the iPhone proved to be original iPhone proved to be a tougher sell than many would have imagined. People had expected something that would support video games and reference books and fancy calculators and word processors and financial spreadsheets right out of the box. The phone they got couldn't yet do that. Now, this is the narrative of the iPhone wasn't any good until the App Store, because the App Store was really great, and that was a lesson Steve had to learn, that he had to turn it around and bring the App Store. That's the story they want to tell. But I have no recollection at all of people being cool on the iPhone when it came out because it didn't run third-party apps. We wanted it to run third-party apps, but my memory of that first 9 months of the iPhone or whatever it was, we were pretty happy with the iPhone.
Yeah, the best part is, like, so video games, maybe, reference books, borderline, fancy calculators, maybe, but word processors? Are you kidding me? People played games on their phone. They played Snake, right? Yeah. You played the little, like, you know what I mean? No one expected a word processor on your phone before the iPhone. When the iPhone was released, they're like, well, it's great, but it's not a word processor. Yeah. Were people doing word processing on their Motorola Razors? No, that's crazy talk. Like, it reveals their it's, they now believe that, like, they've rewound history and said, I always knew that phones would always be like this. And, you know, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. People were going crazy for the iPhone, the fact that it could do any of the things it did. And I think only the tech nerds were like, boy, it would be great to write applications to the phone. But the world at large didn't even think of it. I remember in the Mac world, the keynote when it was announced, Cable Sasser and John Gruber did a podcast. And at one point, Cable said, can we write apps for this phone? Because that would be awesome. The only people who were thinking about writing apps for this were Mac software developers and stuff like that. The general plus USA Today wasn't like, well, this phone is great, but if you can't word process on it, forget it.
If it only had apps like no other phone, then
well, phones did have apps. You could download, again, you could download the Snake game or whatever, but financial spreadsheets and word processors? Come on.
No, they're trying to fit it to a narrative. I mean, those, and honestly, those things bothered me more as I read this book, the idea that they are really kind of rewriting parts of history to fit their thesis and to fit their narrative than the factual stuff. Like I said, later in the book, they say that the iPhone 3G had a faster processor, and that's not true. They say the iPad 2 had a flash. The iPad's never had a flash.
You think that's like, do they mean like flash memory? Then you're trying to decode it. Like, they can't possibly mean like a light that blinks, because
that's what they do. They also suggest that the reason that the iOS didn't support flash is because Adobe angered Steve earlier by either not supporting Next or by building some software for Windows or something like. I don't think that was really the motivator.
That might be true, but if it is, get a quote from somebody
who
says, we were in a meeting with Steve and he said, we're not going
to
put flash on iOS.
Like,
you have to source it. You can't just say Steve Jobs was at it, because Steve Jobs has been mad at Adobe at many times, reportedly, over many things. But is that why he decided to do this feature of this product? You have to source that. You can't just say it.
And the last one, which just made me laugh that I put it in the notes here, is that it is one of the most baldly factually incorrect things. And I just wonder, again, did anybody – it would have been so easy for them to hire a Mac nerd, essentially, to just fact check this and clear this stuff out.
Or look stuff up in Wikipedia. Well,
exactly, because they say, on October 17th, several hundred people attended a memorial service at the Memorial Church on Stanford University's campus. The iPhone 4S had been introduced 2 days earlier in the company's first public event after Steve's death. The event took place the day – now, this is me talking – the event took place the day before Steve Jobs died. It did not take place after Steve's death. It was not the first event after Steve's death. They introduced it with an empty chair in the front row for Steve, and he died the next day. It's so basic, and that is not a far off historical event. That's a couple years ago, and they just got it wrong. And you know, I don't know. It doesn't speak well to the rest of the book. I think that this book is fine, but making all these mistakes, I'm a little baffled by it. And I wonder whether they were just terrified that it was all going to leak and they didn't want to share it with anyone. But it's like simple stuff that doesn't really matter to your overall thesis in a lot of cases. But you could have done a little extra work and made these mistakes all go away, and have people query you on, like, what's your reasoning for saying that the clones were like this, or what's your source about Gil Emilio spending a lot of time on stage because he loved the spotlight, which is not true.
Yeah, or saying, like, do you have different sources than this? Did you just read this in another book or magazine article, or did you talk to somebody about this? Because, like you said, his relationship started around the next year, so everything before the next year he has to be getting from somewhere. And is he just getting it from other books and magazines articles? If it's, that's fine, but if he's going to have different conclusions or assert different facts about it. Like, I keep thinking maybe just take the part that is relevant to you and release it as a really long magazine article or a couple of magazine articles. Why do you need to make a book out of it and pad it out with the stuff that you weren't around for by just summarizing other people's work? And to some degree, like, if you go back and read all these books, you know, you read Infinite Loop and Second Coming of Steve Jobs and Revolution in the Valley and, you know, what is the other one? East of Eden. And just, like, there's a million of these books around that time, Accidental Empires.
Right.
They all talk about the same series of events from different angles, and they're contradictory. Like, some, like, they're dancing around the truth. And I tend to value more the ones that have direct quotes from people who were there, not because their version of events is necessarily correct, but because at least I'm getting one actual perspective. So if I feel like if I can get all of the first-hand perspectives of an event, no one of those accounts of the event will be completely accurate. But if I know all of them, I can kind of get a picture of what they're circling. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's the only way to know what really happened. No one person is going to tell you. But if you take together everybody's event and keep in mind what their motivations were, how that event affected their lives and how, you know, like, that's the only way to know the truth of history. You can't, and that's why you need 1,000 pages to do a biography of Robert Moses. You have to just get every possible angle and build the truth by sort of coloring in the area that's not the truth and coloring in all the people's biases and all the people's reports, and what's left is the truth in the middle.
Yeah, I feel like, I said this after the Isaacson book, and I feel like I have to say it again after this book, which is, it is going to be source material for hopefully another Steve Jobs book that may not be a popular book. It might even be scholarly. I don't know. But I feel like there's like a true story of Steve Jobs book yet to be written that's definitive. And it's going to have to end up taking the material from these books that was actually reported. So in this case, it's going to be the firsthand accounts from the Apple people and the firsthand accounts from the first person one of the two writers. And use that as raw material. Use the raw material from Isaacson where he's reporting what people are saying. And from these other books and other, you know, contemporary reports, and put it together into something that is that puts it in a whole. Because for now, what we end up with is these books where we can pick and choose some things that seem like they're facts, or at least they're a particular person's take on it. But I don't feel like there's a book that I can point to and say, that's the one that's definitive, because they're not definitive. They've got little bits that might hint at the truth, but then there are a lot of other little bits where I feel like this is a fun story, but I've literally read this story a dozen times before.
Yeah, they need to get to these people before they die too.
Yeah,
so that's one angle. And the second angle is, after these people die, you'll probably be able to maybe get access to like all their emails and correspondence. Like, that's where, you know, in the case of like the Robert Moses book, a lot of the times you're going through like public records, public speeches, letters written to people, like, that are only revealed after everyone involved is dead, because you're not going to see someone's personal letters until like the family releases them or whatever. The same things with personal emails. So you need to get the people, interviews with the people while they're alive, and then after everybody dies, you need to get all the correspondence, and then you can build a true history around this type of thing.
Yeah, like a Stanford University oral history project that goes and interviews, and for all we know they did this, but goes and interviews all the people who were involved in Apple in the first decade of the 21st century and says, we're going to put this under lock and key until 50 years from now or until after you die. And or what, you know, whatever circumstances you want.
You got to get their business correspondence, all the paper before there was email, and all, you know, can you imagine how much stuff is in emails, even just in the short amount of time that email existed for Apple's life? Like, that is going to be way more illuminating than interviewing the same three people who are willing to talk for the umpteenth time.
Right. I actually did the story in my my college newspaper. We did a story about the guy who's one of the founders of the university, and when he died, his oral history interview was released, and he said many unkind things about lots of people. It's kind of fascinating. And that's the kind of thing that you don't ever want to say when you have to deal with the consequence. You wait until everybody's dead, and then at least the historians can make some sense of it all. I don't know. Well, I think I'm happy that I read it. I wish it was better. I appreciated their argument, which is basically like people who feel like Steve Jobs was always that one guy and didn't grow as a person in his time away from Apple and came back and then was successful. you know, that their argument is, yeah, he did grow. I suppose you could look at his first tenure at Apple and his tenure at Next and then his second tenure at Apple and say, hey, this guy obviously figured some things out. They try to explain what those things are. I think everybody can judge for themselves whether they're successful or not. But
yeah, I think I might come to a different conclusion. But like, it's clear that the results were different, but I'm not entirely convinced that the results were different because the guy changed that much. He did change. Like, he made different decisions and acted in different ways and surrounded himself by different people. But a lot of it has to do with circumstances.
Yeah, I think their thesis, and I'm not entirely sure I buy this, they really want you to believe that not just failing at Next, but being around Pixar, but not being deep down in it because he couldn't be, because he wasn't a filmmaker, that experience gave him that secret sauce that he didn't have before. And I'm not sure I buy it, but I mean, and Pixar is magical, so that's what they're kind of going for, but I'm not sure I really buy it.
Well, see, like, even if you had an interview with Steve Jobs himself and where he said, you know what really changed me was going to Pixar, and now, you know, if he just repeated that word for word, even that doesn't mean that's the case. That just means that that's what he believes, right? So you really have to get all angles of it. And, like, the stories for both, you know, the Jobs 1 and 2 eras of Apple are so similar in so many ways. They're just framed differently because now it's like, you know,
Steve Jobs came back as the CEO and picked the whole board himself, right? So he would never get fired again.
If the original Steve Jobs was in the same position that the second round Steve Jobs was in, maybe he would have been just as successful. Like, maybe he was just set up for failure because he brought in the adult supervision, because he didn't, you know, maybe it's, you know, didn't trust himself to do all this stuff, but he was Bozos were in charge of him, right?
Yeah.
To use his language, yep. Right? And he was never going to succeed in that thing. And that I think is one of the most fascinating things, where how many people how many potential Steve Jobses are crushed by the fact that they never get into the position where their assets are allowed to result in good outcomes. They're only ever put in, and it's the same guy in both positions, you know what I mean? And this one person happened to have, you know, there's no second act in American Life, so whatever, he had a second and third act, and we got to see, it's kind of like running the trial that, you know, that we get to run the trial three different times. I'm going to put the same guy in three different situations and let's see what happens and what's different, right? Now, he's not obviously the same guy, but like the transformation premise that his time in the wilderness changed him so fundamentally that it was that made it when he came back, he was able to do things better. I think there's some of that, but I think there's an equal amount of same impulses, same guy in maybe now wise enough to know that for him to succeed, he needs to put himself in a different situation.
Yeah. And well, you know, and it's also untestable.
Yeah.
So that
well,
makes
well,
it easy.
Well, you know, the Steve Jobs clones that they have in the underneath the giant circular ring, those will sprout in a couple of decades.
Once we break through to the parallel universes, we'll be able to see all the different outcomes and find the perfect universe. Let's take a break. I've got another sponsor to tell you about. I want to tell you about our friends who make GoToMeeting from Citrix. Think about the time, money, and hassle it takes to hold a meeting. Oh my goodness! You know, if you've got people in the same place, it's hard to schedule them. If you've got people who are all over the internet, in remote offices or working at home, it becomes even much more of a hassle. But you can meet your clients and your coworkers online with Citrix GoToMeeting. It's a smarter way to meet. You can meet with your team wherever you need to, wherever you are. It works on all sorts of different devices. You can meet from any computer, tablet, or smartphone. No travel expenses required, no hassle of traffic. You don't have to go to their office. They don't have to come to your office. You don't have to call that person who works at home and have them make the long drive into the office to be in a one-hour meeting. You click a link. That's it. There are no signups. There are no speed bumps. You click a link and you're in the meeting. You can use your webcam in HD quality. Everybody's there. It's like being in a room together. You can share your screens if you need to present. It all happens in real time. And with GoToMeeting, everybody is seeing what you're seeing, so everybody can get on the same page. Very clever technology. I have used this for business meetings. I have used this for presentations. I've used it for demos where people want to show me a new piece of software that they've written that's going to be coming out, and they'll project it on their screen and they'll walk through the software with me, which is super handy too. So sign up for GoToMeeting today. You can try it free for 30 days. There's nothing to lose. Visit GoToMeeting.com, GOTO meeting.com. Click the try it free button. Do it now and your first meeting will be up and running in minutes. Go to meeting.com for your free 30-day trial. And thank you so much to Citrix and GoToMeeting for sponsoring Upgrade and a good friend. One thing, John, that I thought about, and I thought that I do all these you know, podcasts like Upgrade with youngins who don't remember back in the olden times. One of the things that when I read a book about Steve Jobs that I realize is the narrative takes us away from Apple. And I think in the public consciousness, there's this thought that Steve Jobs left Apple and it all went to hell and then he came back. And it's almost like they can compress it like it took a year or something and then he turned around. But it was like a decade. It was more than a decade that he was gone. And although they ended that period of time, Apple did, on the brink of complete oblivion. And there's a fun section in the book about Fred Anderson taking over as CFO and walking in the door and thinking, oh, my God, what have I done? But you know, that missing decade when Steve Jobs wasn't there, you know, that's when I became a Mac user. That's when I became somebody who devoured all the Mac magazines. And that's when I decided I wanted to write about Apple for my profession. So it couldn't have been all that terrible. And I feel like that decade has now just been kind of like thrown into the trash as a failure. You know, I assume you became a Mac user during the same period, unless you're right at the very beginning, you know, cause Jobs was out of there in 85.
How could you not know this about me? I had the original Mac in 84.
I'm like, did you have it in 84? Did you get it right then? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. I assume that a lot of original Mac owners were actually like, well, it was 85, or well, it was the 512. But no, you're right. You had the 128, so it was 84. Okay. Yeah. So you came in there, and then Steve Jobs abandoned you, or was sent away.
Well, what was I, 9 or 10 or that year? So my recollection of that period was, you know, I got the first Mac, and then I got issue number 1 of Macworld that told the story of the first Mac.
Yep.
They gave me a backstory for
with
this.
With that picture of the team.
Yep. They gave me the backstory on this amazing machine that I had. And at that point, like, from my kid's perspective, there was this amazing team of people, and Steve Jobs was not elevated to the degree that he is now in that story. It was all about the Mac team, and yes, he was the leader of the Mac team, and he was the figurehead, and he, you know, but it was like a team effort. And they made this amazing thing, and this amazing thing went out into the world, and from my perspective as a kid, then this company kept making new versions of this amazing thing. I don't know if I even noticed that Steve Jobs had been kicked out of the company, because corporate, you know, politics are not interesting to a 10 or 11-year-old.
Yeah, who cares?
All I knew was that I was reading Macworld, right, and eventually reading Mac User, and every issue they would have some new technological development relating to the Mac that I would be excited about, and they, you know, they added color with the Mac too, and they kept making new machines, and like, that's what interested me. And it was, I was too young to think what comes after the Mac. Is there, you know, I didn't spare a thought about, by the time I was old enough to care enough about Steve Jobs have been gone, I read all those stories and it's like, well, you know, he was a loose cannon and it could never last. And, you know, Jean-Louis Gasset is my guy because he wanted to add slots and I think that's cool, right? And, you know what I mean? Like this... It seemed fine to me. Only later did I, as the company starts to go down the tubes, you realize, wait a second, this is a company that is iterating on a great idea, but is losing the plot. Like it doesn't understand what it is that made the Mac great. And when faced with any kind of challenge, like say Windows, had no idea what to do. It just flailed wildly. Just, you know, eventually almost became bankrupt. And then I'm just begging for them to buy BOS or something, anything to rejuvenate this company. But for a long stretch there, when I was a kid, it was all about the Mac, the next Mac that was going to come out. And every new Mac was amazing.
Yep.
Like the SE was amazing. The Mac 2, oh my God, color. Like
the PowerBooks.
You know,
the PowerBooks blew
right,
everybody away.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That was not Steve Jobs' thing. The keyboard pushed back, the trackball in the middle. It's like, what? Like that defined the laptop. And just all the crazy frog design things. I think it was a whole issue of Macworld where they had frog design do like, this is what the Mac of the future could look like.
Yep.
I was eating that stuff up. It was like, yes, that's cool.
I hated that issue so much. But yeah.
Because
the way it was framed was like, hey, Apple's designs stink now, so we hired Frog Design. Macworld is here to fix Apple for you.
Right. Thought, well, if Apple made computers out of latex foam, they could look like
they
this.
They could look like this. Mac User, we did a story that was the things from the Apple archive that were the products that were like the concept products that never existed, but at least they were like from Apple. And similarly, they were like, wow, that's weird.
probably
yeah, Knowledge Navigator was yeah. one of the first things I remember seeing go, Apple has no idea what it's doing.
No.
Like, Knowledge ever came out, it's like, seriously, guys?
But the guys who wrote Becoming Steve Jobs, they're business reporters. So they say basically, that, you know, the IBM PC came out and then Apple was irrelevant and Apple remained irrelevant for a decade. Yeah. And I think, well, wait, right. that was the entire period where I fell in love with the Mac, decided I want to read about it voraciously and then write about it. And they're just like, yeah, it's irrelevant. But from a business reporter's perspective, it was kind of irrelevant. But from a user's perspective, it was the 10% of people who chose to be different. And we loved those new Macs that came out and the PowerBook was super influential. It goes against their narrative to say, oh, Apple did some interesting things when Steve Jobs wasn't there. But, you know, I it makes me mad. Now, somebody recommended Infinite Loop, which I haven't read, which
that's
says
me.
That they do. Well, somebody else on Twitter, you also recommended Infinite Loop?
Yes, right? Yes. That's always my go-to for, like, you want to read early Apple history, the best book I found that encompasses all of the early, I think it ends with the iMac. Infinite Loop is the best one.
It gets the lost decade. It gets the decade where a lot of books that are about Steve leave Apple. It's about Apple. So I'm going to read that one because I think that might be the thing that hits the spot for me. But I just think it's really funny that it gets cast off with a hand wave and it, like, encompasses for me the entirety and for you almost the entirety of that time when you become, like, really obsessed with the Mac
but there were so few of us, though. That's why it gets brushed aside, because it is not a pop, like, the popular story is Apple comes from nowhere and as the Apple says, ignites the personal computer revolution, blah blah blah, and makes a bunch of rich people. That's a popular story just because, hey, you know, like one of the first big tech millionaire type stories, right? And the second story is resurgent Apple becomes the biggest company in the world. In between there, it's only an interesting story for people who are interested in technology, because there were just so right. few of us, and we were looked upon as crazy people because only we could see the things that were better about this computer. If you put, you know, for us, it's like, how can you not see how different this is than Windows 3.1? Like, are you serious now? Like, you think these are equivalent? Yes, they both seem to have a mouse, basically the same, right?
Yeah, what? Windows,
like, and
whatever.
And it was like this nuanced distinction that made us kind of snooty and weird, and it's clear that's not what the world wants. And we sort of hung out in obscurity, really interested in this one little company making a small number of computers that were increasingly irrelevant. And yet that company continued to make very interesting, exciting, good products right up to the point where it stopped really doing that and then kind of, you know, crumbled into dust. Like, business-wise, the company didn't have its act together, but product-wise, it was doing amazing things.
It did. I mean, in the chat room, we have a quote from the New York Times from 1993 pointing out that during Scully's reign, company sales went from $800 million a year to $8 billion a year. I mean, they did grow, but they also became increasingly irrelevant. But I feel like there was a really good period in there where they were doing interesting things. But, you know, this it's what you said. Think of it this way. What's the market for Becoming Steve Jobs? I feel like there's really two markets there. There's the market of people who just love Apple and want to read about Apple, and they're the tech nerds. And then there's the market that's the business media market, which I think these guys, given their background, that is really what they're targeting here. This is a book that's going to be read by people who want to learn lessons about how Steve Jobs dealt with adversity and how he built such a creative team and all of that. And for us Apple nerds, we look at this book and say, one, we say things like, I can't believe that they said that the iBook was black because it was the MacBook, which, you know, again, the business people, they don't care at all. But we're just trying to glean the stuff that we think is interesting out of it, because we think the technology story is interesting there. That's probably not what that book is meant for. That book is by business journalists, and it's trying to make a lot of money from people who want to get, you know, inspiration from the life of Steve Jobs because they believe that they can be the next Steve Jobs, or they can learn how to be a good CEO by reading a lot of business books. And I think that's at some of the conflict here. And I realized that as I read that statement, but I still kind of got offended because it's like, hey, you were just casting off this whole period where I got really excited about this stuff and then wanted to read about it and wanted to write about it. And you're like, yeah, it was irrelevant. Forget about it. But from their perspective, it totally was. I get it.
Yeah. A more tech-focused angle would focus on what are the similarities between the Apple of that era, the Scully Apple, like the things that Apple did well. The PowerBook is a great example. It is like the iPhone in that it sort of redefined the form factor of an existing product.
And it was hot. I mean, it was like... I remember reading stories about famous people spotted with power books. Like, it was like the cool thing to be seen with in 1992.
Right. And after that, every laptop eventually looked like a power book, yeah. Right? That it was not in the same way that eventually every phone looked like an iPhone, roughly speaking. And so the thing to compare would be like, what is different? How did they snatch defeat from the jaws of victory in the Scully era and the reverse? And, you know, because it was like the company that Jobs had founded had these good qualities. I mean, again, Jobs came and took over. He didn't fire all the employees and start a new company. The people who did all this stuff, like Johnny Ive, was there, right? They had him slapping ugly plastic cases around performers, right?
Like, yeah, he did the E-mate, and that was interesting, and he put that little green triangle on the G3.
Yeah, he did the beautiful Newton message pad 110. Right, yeah. He did the 20th anniversary Mac. Like, those people were all in the company. All these people that did these amazing things, they just were not being utilized. And like, that's the story. It's not so much, you know, when Steve Jobs was gone, the company couldn't do any good. And when he came back, they did better. How? He didn't do the work himself. Those people are already there. And so it's again in the same way that Steve Jobs was set up for failure. You had all these amazing smart people who were ready to do great things, and then management. Who, like, they did great things, like, in spite of management towards the end there, not because of. Like, they were not, the priorities were lost. And again, you have Scully as the CEO didn't quite know what to prioritize.
The board then also gets a lot, I think, needs to take a lot of the blame. To use that Jobs term again, I think the board were a bunch of bozos. Because when they got rid of Scully, not to bring sports into this for a minute, so forgive me, but... you know, there are stories about teams that fire their coach, and they fire the coach because they know who they're going to hire. And then there are those teams, usually bad teams, that fire the coach and then think, okay, now let's start looking for a coach. And I feel like that's what the Apple board was like here, which was, okay, we got to get rid of Scully. And then they were like, now what? Hey, Michael Spindler sold a lot of computers in Germany. Let's try him out.
Yeah. Do any of you guys know anybody who knows anything about computers?
Emilio he's got a PhD and knows about semiconductors.
Oh, he's a turnaround artist. We got a turnaround here. We need to get a turnaround specialist to come in.
But
that's
artful.
All it takes. You don't need to know anything about Apple. You just know how to turn companies around.
Yeah. It's just a ship that's leaking. From they do tell that story well. The Apple's a ship, and it's got a leak, and it's my job to get it to safe harbor. And then he walks away, and everybody looks at each other and says, "What about the leak?" Gil, Emilio, fascinating, yes. Fascinating. But so I think the board takes some of the blame because they made that moment. I was like, okay, Scully, it's not working. We need to do something else. And it's like, could they have made Apple? Could Apple have not maybe gone so far down in flames if they had brought somebody in who had a clue? Maybe not, but they didn't bring in somebody who had a clue. They brought in Spindler and Emilio.
To be fair to Scully, Apple was in essentially a losing position by the time they kicked Steve Jobs out. Like, there was not, they could, even if they had just merely maintained, like, tried to, and they did try to sort of maintain the course or whatever. Like, the IBM PC was a real problem for them, right? Because you and I both know, once the momentum started to go, once the conventional wisdom became that the Mac and Apple are oddball, and the rest of the world and serious business people are always going to use PCs with Windows and dot, like, that narrative is a big problem for the Mac. And Apple, even if Steve Jobs had been there, Apple would have needed to do something dramatic to turn that around. And so Scully did nothing to turn it around. Scully was like, let's go with it. Fine. We will be the boutique high end. We're going to go after the artists. We're going to go after desktop publishing. Like, just, you know, they went in the direction they could go in and they milked that. But they didn't have, you know, as Steve Jobs would say, you milk the Mac for all it's worth and get started on the next big thing. Mm-hmm. They milked the Mac by fleeing from the fight that they were just didn't want to engage in at all. And they had no next plan. They had no next thing to replace it. So they were just like, they were getting while the getting's good, or whatever the expression is. Right.
The Newton was
their attempt at that.
Well, I don't necessarily believe this, but let me say it just to try it on as a defense of John Scully. It's like, okay, what was John Scully's approach here? They created premium price products in specific markets where they did well and that they could charge that extra money. And they did well with that. And they were profitable for a long time with that.
Well, they did well, but not in big picture. Like found their niche, their corner of the market, and they said, we can wring a lot of money out of this corner of the market because it's a lucrative corner of the market. Right. But they had no sort of end game. Is this a sustainable business?
If you're Scully, the battle's already lost. You're never going to be the IBM PC. So instead, you're like, well, look, we can build a business off here in the corner and all of that. And then to Scully's credit, he's like, let's do a handheld computer.
That was his vision. And like, that's the amazing thing. Like that. All right. So two things there. One, like, oh, the battle's already lost. We're never going to be on the NPC. He was in there early enough that that wasn't true. He didn't have to be that fatalistic. Like, in hindsight, we can say, oh, well, like, the thing they were set up, they needed to do something big. But in the beginning, you know, in 85, when Steve Jobs is just out, the battle's not entirely lost at that point. It is still winnable without Steve Jobs if you took it. But he's like, no, we're not even going to try for that battle, right? And then the Newton, that just goes to show, like, he wanted to be a technical visionary. Like, he wanted to show off his tech chops. And he had a reasonably good idea about the whole personal digital assistant thing. And the people at Apple were so amazing that they actually did make the game really close to everything that we know would eventually define the future of mobile computing with the Newton. Like, they were so ahead of their time. They were just a little bit too early and made a few mistakes. And the company wasn't really behind them. And they really shouldn't have launched when they launched. Like, just, you know, the Newton was close. And the fact that Newton was that close with such not incompetent leadership, but with sort of fumbling leadership, it just shows how much talent there was sitting there in Apple. How many talented, passionate people who were just waiting to be asked to do something great that they just misfired by a little bit, and then it went off the side and it ricocheted and just kind of, you know, fizzled out into an egg freckles poof of dust, like the drawings on a Newton, right?
Eat up Martha.
Right. And so, like, you know, it's that's why I think it wouldn't have taken, you didn't need Steve Jobs to turn things around against the PC. You just needed somebody who had a little bit more of a clue about what the situation would be like.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why I'm fascinated by that period, because there's like, it's not like it was a total void and there were tumbleweeds blowing through. There was interesting things that happened there, and they weren't successful really, but they were interesting. And I literally, my first month on the job at Mac User as an intern was when they introduced the Newton. So I was boarding a sinking ship, let me tell you. And it was fascinating, but that was by the time I got to Mac User. I remember my first briefing at Apple was for the Quadra 630. I want to say it was not a 4-digit number, so it was not a Power Mac. And I was there for the Power PC transition, but it was like a Quadra 630. I want to say, which is weird. It had the TV tuner and it had like a motherboard that you could slide out the back, which was weird. And I think of that era, and I think that was when things really started to get strange at Apple. That was when they did the Mac TV. They launched all the Performas, 80 billion different Performas.
They were selling them through Sears. Yeah, yep. it was a confusing time.
And the one at JCPenney had a different number than the one at Sears, because maybe the bundle was different of like software that they put on them. It was a very confusing time. And that's actually when I entered. And so I think about that period now. And I didn't get to see, as a professional, I didn't get to see even the heyday of the Mac. It was really all starting to spin apart in what was that, the summer of 93.
Yeah. And you know, thinking about the Newton, like, again, how close it was, the fact that, so the Newton didn't quite hit its mark, and then, like, more or less hot on its heels came the Palm to show that, like, you were just off by a little bit.
Just,
and the Palm was, like, just so much more primitive and so much smaller and so much cheaper. And like the business narrative then was, see, Apple, you tried to make this big, fancy, expensive thing that can do a lot of stuff, when really you should have just gone cheaper, because the most important thing was small, cheap, lightweight. And that was totally the narrative that Apple had decided to go sort of like everything in the kitchen sink. We're just going to make everything a revolution, and this is a platform that can replace the Mac, and it's this amazingly powerful thing, and there's data soup instead of files, and it's just like, why don't you just do something like handwriting recognition? We'll just do graffiti on this little dedicated area. We're not even letting you write on the screen. It's like, why didn't you just do the stupidest thing? Like, you dummy Apple, you're always trying to do these sort of highfalutin, like, amazing, everything's got to be a revolution like the Mac. What dummies you are. When Steve Jobs came back and he, you know, his first big breakout product, not the iPod, but certainly the iPhone, They did exactly what the Newton was trying to do. We're revolutionizing everything. We are going to make the most amazing thing you've ever seen. No, we're not going to make you write in a little area. No, we're not going to make you use a pen. It's like the iPhone was the Newton strategy, not the Palm strategy. It was the Newton strategy where they actually did it, right?
Yeah.
And it's like the business narratives love to just find out who the winner is in the market and then retroactively make a narrative that says, this is the way you should do things. If you're going to do something, you should always make the simplest, most primitive things possible. Don't reach for the stars because you'll never hit them and it's pointless. And it's like, they hit it with the Mac. They hit it with the iPhone. Maybe they'll hit it with the watch. Maybe not. But it's like the iPhone was just totally the Newton strategy and not the Palm strategy. And now, what's the business narrative around the? I guess the business narrative around the iPhone is Steve Jobs' magic. I don't know.
Well, I do think that one of the good things, and I think I said this when the Isaacson book came out too, is one of the positive things about all these Steve Jobs biographies and being pitched at business people and being taught in business schools and all of those things is I feel like, yeah, if they take away Steve Jobs' magic, then what can you do? You know, be magic. But I do think, like, for all those years where they said, look, what Apple did, don't pay attention to it. The answer is not to do, you know, interesting things. The answer is to go as cheaply as possible. And, like, the antithesis of what Apple was always about. And Apple's success has made it hard to go down that path and ignore what Apple has done. And so even though I don't entirely agree with a lot of these books or even some of the premises that they have, I think it's interesting that we may end up with a generation of business people who have values that are maybe a little closer to Apple in a way that would not have been the case with anybody coming up in the 80s and 90s when Apple was like poison.
Well, the lesson should not be like, I hope the lesson at this point is that conventional wisdom is often wrong.
Yeah.
And so like, don't do like, you need to license your operating system. Well, no, you don't. You need to do what Steve Jobs does. Well, no, you don't. What you need to do may be entirely different than what Bill Gates did, what Steve Jobs did the first time, what Steve Jobs did the second time. Like that should be the lesson, not whatever the most recent successful thing is.
Do that.
That's what all leaders should do. The lesson should be that a wide variety of strategies can and have worked, and it really, you should really just not look back and say, I need to do whatever Facebook did because I want to be the next Facebook. Like, hopefully that is a lesson that anyone with a long view would take. And you're right that having lots of these different stories kills the previous narrative, like that you have to just make the software because software is high margin and you need to license your operating system. And like, you know, because for the longest time Windows was so dominant that it was like Bill Gates has defined the model, the business model for the future of technology.
Microsoft.
Right, exactly. And that was the only possible, either be Microsoft or be bought by Microsoft. And then Apple killed that one. But now it shouldn't be like, oh, you got to do the Apple strategy.
Right.
No, we need someone else to come along and kill the Apple strategy by doing whatever the opposite of Apple is and being fabulously successful and when we're old grandparents, right?
Although I would rather have today's up-and-coming business people look at Apple and say, hey, Apple cares about design and is trying to build products that people want to buy instead of just assembling technology together. And that's what we should do when we build products. I feel like that would be a good lesson for people who want to be tech people to learn. And I think that some up-and-coming tech people have learned that lesson as opposed to the old lesson, because the old lesson was literally like, just take a bunch of crap, make it compatible, sell it for as cheap as you can, and then move on to the next thing.
That's our bitter Mac user perspective.
Yeah,
but I think it builds, like, because the Bill Gates lesson really was the old own and control mantra from Apple. Like, it's really important for you to understand what your power position is in the market. Like, you need to be the master of your own destiny. You need to make sure IBM lets you license MS-DOS to other people. Stick that clause in your contract because that will make the future of your company. That you need to be shrewd about your business deals and understand where the value is in the future, right? And that argument didn't go away. Steve Jobs did all that in his second run at Apple. He made sure that his business arrangements and everything were set up. Like, it didn't mean he did the exact same thing, but he made sure that he controlled the platform, mm-hmm. that his deals with the carriers were so lopsided so that he controlled the experience with the whole app store so that Apple could control the applications, the, you know, security and viruses and all this other stuff, right? That was him playing out the Bill Gates lessons. And then, of course, the Apple lesson is, at this point, technology is ubiquitous enough that it's like a consumer product and you have to incorporate design, right? And then maybe the Apple Watch lesson is you have to incorporate fashion or whatever. The next one is going to be, I learned the Bill Gates lesson, I learned the Steve Jobs lesson, I learned the Apple Watch lesson, and then I'm going to build on that. So they really do, it's not like one counteracts the other, it's you have to learn all the lessons and incorporate them possibly in a different way. Like the lesson Steve Jobs learned from Microsoft of like seeing how their position at the top of the market was only possible because of the smart moves they made early on about which parts they controlled and which parts other people controlled. Apple took that lesson to heart and used it for hardware, saying we don't have to own all the factories, but we have to make sure all our dealings with the people who make hardware for us are such that we are in the position of power always, that we control. Like, and you know, if they make ARM Max, we'll have this discussion all over again of like, we don't even want Intel making the chips because that is too much of taking control out of our hands. So they're sort of using the Microsoft strategy that they did with software and controlling the market through software and doing it on the hardware side.
Yeah, and in reality, the sad thing, not to be a little cynical, but the lesson people are going to take, most people are going to take from things like this is, oh, I'm going to just do that, which is not, you know, I'm going to do what Steve Jobs did, which is not.
They're welcome to try. Good luck. You know, it's not like these are all possible models that can work. But if you're just looking to have a successful business, almost any of these strategies can work if you execute them well. If you're looking to become the next Apple, the next Facebook, the next Microsoft, you will probably need to incorporate the lessons of all the past people and do something and repurpose them for, you know, the modern age, which is going to be different than the situation was for any of those past people.
Let me take a break for our last sponsor. It's MailRoute. If you imagine a world without spam, viruses, or bounced email, MailRoute can provide it. You can open your email and see only the legitimate mail you want and need to receive. The way it works, MailRoute servers intercept your mail. You set your MX record on your domain, and you do need to know what that is and how to do it. You point that at MailRoute. MailRoute servers take in all your inbound mail, and they filter out the bad stuff. And then they pass the good stuff onto your server. So your server only ever sees the good stuff. You don't have to maintain any special hardware or software. MailRoute handles it all for you in the cloud, and their intelligent software can detect what is bad, what's got viruses, what is spammy, and filter it out so it doesn't even get to you. It is easy to set up and reliable. It's trusted by large universities and corporations. If you're a desktop user, you'll find it a super simple interface to use. It's easy to set up. You've got a web interface to set all your different mail route settings for you as a single user. And if you're an email administrator or an IT pro, they've got all the tools that you need built for you. There's an API for account management. There's support for LDAP and Active Directory, TLS, mailbagging. Mike isn't here to give me a verbal high five for mailbagging, outbound relay, everything else that you'd want from the people who handle your mail. And the best part, you can start a risk-free trial. There's no credit card required to sign up. You sign up, change your MX records to point them at MailRoute and your mailbox, and hardware will be completely protected. It's simple and effective, so give it a try. And if you're an upgrade listener, you can receive 10% off for the lifetime of your MailRoute account. So after that free trial is done and you want to sign up, you have to go to mailroute.net/upgrade. Go there now and sign up. And after the free trial, 10% off for the lifetime of your account. Thank you to MailRoute for keeping my mailbox spam-free and for being a good friend of Upgrade and of Relay FM. Thank you, MailRoute. So, John, at dinner at the UL conference, I was sitting with, at the big banquet, I was sitting with Mike and with Marco and Tiff and with Georgia and Serenity was at a different table, I think. A bunch of really good people. And John Gruber appeared as with one of those little telepresence robots, and he actually fell off the stage as a robot. So he'd had too much to drink, I think. But we were discussing a concept that you and I have talked about before, which is the argument about what's a robot and what's not a robot. And so I wanted to ask you briefly before we wrap the show, are you willing to discuss a few posits in the robot or not genre?
If you insist, but if we're ever going to have our own podcast about this, we're just stealing our own thunder.
Or are we promoting? So I'm going to limit it, but I'm excited about the possibility that we could do a podcast in which we determine whether things are robots or not. But I wanted to, so this is where it started. Is we had the incomparable draft about we had computers and we had robots, and the computer draft was recorded first, and somebody picked Kit from Knight Rider as a computer, and so then in the robot draft, somebody tried to pick Car, the evil Knight Rider car. And I said that wasn't a robot, and that led to an entire discussion that we had over dinner in Ireland, because we were really exciting people about what.
Are you leaving out the most important part of your selection?
Oh, and then later, Steve Letts drafted the '80s dance, the robot,
yes,
and I said
nice
that was
admit,
a robot.
Admit, yes. Yes, you said you. Let's repeat this again for the audience.
Yes,
you said that the dance robot from the '80s is a robot.
Yes, I did say that.
That led to me yelling at you about knowing what is a robot and what is not a robot.
I admit that was indefensible, but I felt like Steve, I had to give something to Steve at that point. I felt
never
like
give
he
anything
needed
to Steve.
It. No, that's true. That's a strong point on your part. So without getting too far down here, because I want this to be a promotion from our glorious new podcast that we will do at some point, maybe possibly about whether things are robots or not. Leaving the fact that the robot that's a dance is totally not a robot aside, what do you think of this question that, and this was one of the most divisive things at dinner, was like Kit, okay, from Knight Rider, is an intelligent car. So it's mobile on its own. It's got a voice. It can think for itself. It can talk to others, but it doesn't have like arms or anything. It just kind of is a self-driving car that's intelligent. So this is what I want you to think about and tell me is what makes something a robot versus not a robot? Because I view Kit as a computer.
All right.
Well, I mean, I think one of the questions is about vehicles, because the argument that I made was, if you think Kit is a robot, then do you think the USS Enterprise is a robot? Because it, too, is a vehicle with an intelligent computer that can even create its own sentient beings in its holodeck if it wants to.
Yeah, as I think we discussed when thinking about this podcast, a robot or not, in the first episode, you would imagine that we would have to sit down and hammer out the definition of a robot, and then all subsequent episodes would simply be applying this definition to other things in a boring way. Because once we defined it, there's no point in having other episodes. If we can come to an agreement on what a robot is, it's obvious what you know. So,
which means we also need to disagree about the definition of what a robot is. Or there's
but
also
then
the podcast
that's intractable. Like, if we're going to convince each other or whatever.
Interesting.
So do you want me to make a ruling on Kit versus the Enterprise?
No, well, I mean, I don't know. I feel like that is an interesting debate to have about if an autonomous vehicle that is itself sentient, is that a robot? Because what makes a robot a robot? Is it that it is mobile and intelligent? Or is it that it sort of appears like a human being? Well, let's do something easy, just as a proof of concept here. The telepresence robot that John Gruber was driving around the stage at Ool, robot or not?
Not a robot.
Not a robot. Because all it is a piece of hardware. It's an iPad on a stick.
If you could put John Gruber inside there, and that's the only place John Gruber existed, then we're talking about robots.
Interesting.
But John Gruber is not inside
no.
the thing. It is merely just an iPad on wheels, and he's sitting comfortably in his house.
Okay. That's good.
But if John Gruber only existed inside that little stick on wheels, robot.
Inside. No, okay. So now let me follow this up just a little bit. Again, just we're workshopping here. If John Gruber's brain was put in a computer, but it was like in a mainframe, like they have on television whenever they have to hack something, it's a mainframe. It was a big supercomputer somewhere that was just large enough to hold the entirety of John Gruber. But it was like in a big bunker in like underneath the Rocky Mountains. But it was connected to the internet to that telepresence robot on stage in Ireland. Is that a robot or is that just a computer that's controlling a thing? Is that different?
Yeah, that's different because the big mainframe thing is not a robot. Again, it would have to be the only place that John Gruber exists would have to be in that thing.
All right.
That it's moving around. You know
I think
what I mean?
We're making progress. I think we're making progress. Now, a Roomba, robot or not?
Sure.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be sentient. But I mean,
otherwise, we can only talk about science fiction. Then,
right.
Because we don't have any actual sentient machines. So.
That's good. Is Siri a robot?
No.
Good. I think this proves just how brilliant the robot or not.
Is love a robot, Jason? Robot?
That's an interesting question, John. Well, Webster's dictionary defines love.
What is love, Jason?
It's
baby, don't hurt me.
Love is a robot.
Don't hurt me. No more.
All right. Well, John, It has been a pleasure having you on Upgrade. This was actually a lot of fun. And you'll be happy to know that in the great tradition of Upgrade, we have lots and lots of things on the show notes that we didn't get to. But that's fine. We all that
robot
always
or
happens.
Not is at the bottom. We got everything, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, I skipped some stuff in the middle because we've been going on.
We talked about
the old times. We complained about books. We did a lot of good stuff. So, I thank you so much for coming on. I had that thought when Mike said, I can't do this. I'm going to be on vacation. I have to go to Dracula's castle.
He's so lazy, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, some of us take our microphones with us when we
Seriously,
go on vacation.
Like, what's his problem? Like, he can't do a simple podcast? Well, like, what else does he have to do with his day?
He's on vacation with his girlfriend. And I think that, you know, unlike us who are old married people, he needs to not, like, tell his girlfriend, I'm going to go away for 2 hours and do a podcast. So... I think
he does like one podcast a month, right? He's not busy at all.
Yeah, he's six. He does more podcasts than I do.
I know,
which is shocking. But it's good because when people say, "Oh my god, I can't believe you do four podcasts a week," I go, "Yeah, you should meet Mike.
He does four podcasts a day." Yeah. Have you checked that he's not twins or triplets?
Well, I can't prove that because I only ever saw one of him. I have seen him in real life, and in fact, just did. But I. You can't prove that there isn't another one somewhere doing
podcasts.
If
you saw him at UL and like you saw him for 5 minutes and then you saw him for 5 minutes later and you realized when you previously saw him he didn't have a beard, but now that he does, you're like, wait a second. You couldn't have grown that beard that fast.
You would really recognize if Mike didn't have a beard because it is a prominent beard.
What I'm saying, maybe one of the Mikes has a beard.
Yeah. Yeah, well that would not be a sufficient. You couldn't take that mic as his duplicate.
Next time you see him, put your hand in there and pull really hard, because that could be fake.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, so this is my point, is that if Mike does have doubles, he didn't bring them with him, so far as we know. Or they had the same beard that he had. They were not beardless. He must leave the beardless mic duplicate at home just to record and sends the beardy one out in public.
Well, anytime he wants to briefly have a normal life, I'm happy to fill in.
Well, I appreciate that. And it was fun to talk about computer things with you, which we've talked about before, just not when we were recording on a podcast. So
yes, that is definitely true.
It was a nice thing. So thank you. And of course, everybody should, I don't know why they wouldn't have already done this, but they should listen to the Accidental Tech Podcast, which you can find on iTunes or at atp.fm. And John,
sing
you
a song. Go ahead.
and John is on Twitter, SIRACUSA, Syracuse.
You got it.
I know it well. And as always, this episode, always and forever, will be at relay.fm/upgrade/30, or the show notes are in your podcast app of choice. Mike will be back next week with me. Thank you once again to our sponsors, 1Password, GoToMeeting, and MailRoute. And thanks to everybody out there for listening. We will see you soon.
Am I going to be re-energized when he comes back?
Or drained of all blood because he visited Dracula's castle.
I didn't know that he was
there. Yeah. Yeah, he was high in the Carpathian Mountains. Dracula was my senior class play. I know every time he mentions that he's going to Romania, I say, oh, it's a remote region in Romania, because that's what Transylvania is. That was one of my lines. Where's Transylvania? It's a remote region in Romania.
What do you think about that when you see your kids doing activities at school and you're like... Yeah. You're going to remember some stupid part of this activity that you're doing for the rest of your life. So whatever line you have in the school play, be prepared to know that when you're 40.
Forever. That's right.
I hope it's a good one.
Yeah. It's a remote region in Romania.
I don't know how you did doing that.
No, I think in that play I had the most dialogue, but I wasn't one of the stars. I was like the guy who owned the house where the play takes place. So as the host, I kept appearing and saying things that were sort of like either expository or just moving the story along. And so I had lots and lots of dialogue to say that I had to memorize. I've never done anything like that before. but my character was not particularly interesting in any way. I was not Dracula. I was not Von Helsing.
It was setting you up for your career as a journalist.
Yeah, that's right. I was just the guy there saying, hey, this is my house. And Transylvania? It's a remote region in Romania, in the high end of Carpathia.
I meant in the way that it was not setting you up for your career as an actor.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. Well, that was the perfect part. Actually, you could argue that having me have lots of dialogue was maybe not the best choice, but, you know, it was the part I was born to play. Mr. Generic Exposition Guy. No acting required. Just read the lines. And so I did.